If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. There are several different tiers available with perks to go along with each, including an exclusive monthly series available only on Patreon. We sincerely appreciate all donations as they help cover the costs associated with research and production. Thanks, y'all. We'd also like to ask that you stick around until the end of the episode for a promo of our friend and fellow Texans podcast, Swindled. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
But I did have several inmates tell me he's one of the most cold-blooded people they'd ever met. Sure enough, bad actors, convicts that were in there for murders and a few other things.
The abduction and murder of Carla Walker has largely been defined in the press for many years by one individual's narrative. John Terrell was a burglary detective in 1974 and would retire as such several years later, turning down, according to him, a promotion to homicide. After he retired, he dedicated a majority of his time and efforts to finding Carla's killer, or rather proving that he knew who Carla's killer was. Terrell was written up with unfettered praise several times by local journalists, his investigative efforts often written as gospel by several local news sources. It's understandable because Terrell's narrative reads like a detective magazine story. It's almost irresistible. This is the story of Detective John Terrell's obsessive crusade. On August 27, 1973, a young Texas Christian University student, Jennifer, struggled to start the ignition of her car. A man began approaching the vehicle, but just before he got near the car, it fired up. They waved at each other. Jennifer attended her classes and returned home later that afternoon. Not long after, a knock was heard at the young student's door. She opened the door, and the man who had attempted to help her earlier was standing on the stoop. Jennifer was new to the neighborhood, having only moved in 3 weeks prior, and the man said he'd come to welcome her. He'd already tried to help her with her car trouble, she thought, and she appreciated that he also wished to show her the kind gesture of welcoming her to the neighborhood. They chatted briefly, and Jennifer asked the man if he wanted to come in. He accepted. "I'm afraid of dogs," the man said as her bulldog growled at the stranger entering. "Can you do something with him?" Jennifer apologized and put the animal outside. The man complimented Jennifer's record player, and as the young student turned to look, the man forced himself behind her, putting a knife to her throat. He bound her hands with pantyhose he'd found in her drawer. He began undressing her, but stopped as he noticed the open blinds. When the man went to draw the blinds, Jennifer freed her hands. She began struggling with him and landed a blow to his head. He became angry and even more forceful, pulling the knife back up to Jennifer's throat. The man sexually terrorized the young woman for 3 hours and ended the assault by ejaculating on Jennifer's chest. He calmly got up, straightened the room, and walked out the door. The police were notified immediately by Jennifer. They failed to photograph her cuts and bruises. William Ted Wilhoit was arrested for the assault on Jennifer just days later and charged with criminal attempted rape. The case went to trial in March of 1974, and the jury found Wilhoit not guilty of the assault, partially because he did not ejaculate inside the young woman, which the defense argued as a technicality for not fitting the then-legal definition of rape provided by the state of Texas. The jurors' justifications for this verdict quickly hit the press and included such quotes as, "She probably led the man on and then felt her boyfriend would get mad. We felt like she had a lot of chances to get away. I think she was egging him on." If a woman is going to ask a man into her home, she knows what he's doing. And it wasn't a bad rape, after all. End quotes. On June 11, 1974, just over 3 months after Carla Walker's body was found, a 20-year-old Texas Christian University foreign language major was sitting on the steps of her above-garage studio apartment, taking in the summer night. Janelle Kirby lived just a few streets east of campus and had only moved from the dormitories 3 weeks prior. A clean-cut, nicely dressed young man approached the student and, after exchanging pleasantries, asked to use her phone. The young man was cordial and seemingly harmless. Janelle felt she had no reason to deny the man. After all, the neighborhood was safe and quiet, particularly in the summer when the keg parties were at a minimum. The two climbed the 15 feet or so up the steps and into the apartment. The young woman entered before the young man, and as she turned around to face him, he forcefully grabbed her, pointing a pistol close to her face. "Place your hands on the bed," he told her as he let go of her and reached into his pocket. He pulled out a pair of handcuffs and securely fastened one wrist. As he reached for Janelle's other wrist, she saw an opportunity to act and quickly attempted to grab the man's pistol. They struggled with one another, each desperately trying to gain the upper hand, and both fell to the floor in the process. She began screaming. The attacker wasted no time covering Janelle's mouth with his hand and commanded, "Keep quiet," but the brave young woman immediately bit his hand upon his order. The man instantly pulled his hand away, startled by the co-ed's audacity, and rose from the floor. He pointed his pistol at her, both hands gripping the weapon, and began firing. Janelle was hit 5 times. The man rummaged through her purse. "You coward," the young woman mumbled. The assailant hastily exited the apartment. The co-ed was unable to rise to her feet, but was able to drag herself to the steps of the apartment, make her way down, and crawl to the driveway that joined the garage. A neighbor of the young woman, who was a registered nurse, came upon her. As the neighbor approached Janelle, the young woman muttered, "Please don't hurt me." Janelle was taken to Cook's Children's Hospital, where the nurse was employed, and subsequently taken to Harris Hospital for emergency surgery. The 20-year-old student would remain in critical care for days, undergoing more surgeries and some close calls, but ultimately, and miraculously, Janelle survived the attack. The Fort Worth Star-Telegram reports just after the attack described the aftermath as 5 gunshot wounds to the head and chest. Because of her condition, it was days before the police could question her thoroughly. The very morning before this terrible and merciless attack, the Texas Christian College student wrote a letter to her boyfriend describing an incident that had occurred just after 1 a.m. upon walking home from her place of employment. She was scared to death, the letter said, after being followed by a man in a white car. The man was driving slow beside Janelle, trying to coax her into the vehicle. She refused. The man stopped the car and began to get out. The young woman sprinted to a Jack in the Box restaurant to seek refuge. After explaining what had just taken place, the manager of the establishment walked the young woman home. Janelle pointed out a strange unoccupied vehicle parked on the street near her apartment to the night manager as they drew near, a white, possibly Chevrolet Auto, saying that this might have been the car the stalker was driving. She would reaffirm this to her boyfriend in the letter, only she was even more positive that it was the car. The letter reached Janelle's boyfriend's home in a neighboring county the next day, but he was already en route to Fort Worth to be with the young woman in the hospital. The TCU student was quoted as saying she'd have no problem identifying the man, and after being shown several mugshots on several separate occasions, she chose a photo of a man named Kenneth Leslie Miller as her assailant. Kenneth Miller was in the process of bringing civil rights violations against a Fort Worth narcotics officer and was well known to them as a result. He'd been in and out of the custody of the Fort Worth Police Department for minor drug violations only a couple times, but never convicted of any serious crime. He was convicted of the attack on Janelle Kirby on April 1, 1975. Sentencing could wait until after the weekend, Judge Byron Matthews decided in a bench meeting with both the defense and prosecution. It was Easter, and Judge Matthews was allowing Miller to remain free on bond until the following Monday. While the judge and attorneys were discussing the terms, Miller calmly turned around and walked out of the courthouse. He was observed by witnesses running down the street shortly thereafter, but it would be the last time Kenneth Leslie Miller would be seen for 11 years. In March of 1975, just days before Miller's trial began, Fort Worth police burglary detective John Terrell received a phone call from a local bank that a man was attempting to cash two $500 savings bonds. They were stolen. The description of the man given by the bank matched that of a man who Terrell had arrested in January of the previous year for a residential burglary. That man was William Ted Wilhoit. Wilhoit was the adopted son of two very religious school teachers and was himself considered to be as religious as they. Terrell and his partner, Fort Worth burglary detective Joe Britt, left their desks to seek out the then 21-year-old Wilhoit for questioning and the attempted savings bond cashing, as well as stolen guns that had been sold to a local pawn shop. Wilhoit matched the description of the seller of the weapons as well. When they arrived at his home, William Ted Wilhoit was standing in his front yard. Detective Terrell called him over to the car, and he took a seat in the back. According to Terrell and Britt, the first words from Wilhoit's mouth were, "Well, I was wondering when you were going to come after me for Carla Walker." They didn't show their surprise, and told him they were actually there to talk about stolen guns. Wilhoit signed a consent to search then and there, waiving his Fourth Amendment rights against search and seizure. Many items in the home were noted as potentially stolen. Terrell claims that after briefly questioning Wilhoit at police headquarters about the guns, the detective changed the subject of the conversation to Carla Walker. Terrell said that he began a series of psyche-beating suggestions to Wilhoit, telling him that the life he was leading was in dire contrast to his religious beliefs, and having knowledge of the attack in 1973 in which he'd been found not guilty, that he had potentially damning sexual desires that are acted out in the form of assault. He told Wilhoit that Carla was also a member of a Church of Christ. Terrell claims that Wilhoit began sobbing. "Ted, why don't you just tell me about it?" the detective said. "I guess I might as well," Terrell reported Wilhoit as saying. At that moment, Terrell recounts, a federal agent knocked on the door, interrupting Wilhoit's would-be confession. The federal agent was there because the stolen savings bonds rendered Wilhoit's crime a federal offense, as they were taken from a mailbox. First thing the next morning, Detective John Terrell informed Homicide Detective George Hudson about William Ted Wilhoit and his suspicions regarding the Carla Walker case. The following day, a search warrant for Wilhoit's home had gone through and was signed by a judge. Detectives Hudson, Terrell, and Britt, Wilhoit in tow, searched the home and named many items thought to be stolen on the warrant affidavit. Instruction manuals and pawn tickets for a .22 caliber Ruger pistol were also found, a similar type of gun in which a clip was found on the scene of Carla's abduction, along with other unnamed items. A bag of women's panties were found, according to Terrell. Wilhoit made a remark that they belonged to his wife, who overheard her husband's claim and denied that the panties were hers. Wilhoit admitted to and helped clear several burglaries, and his probation for a former burglary in which Terrell was the arresting officer was revoked. Detective John Terrell was convinced that William Ted Wilhoit was responsible for the abduction and murder of Carla Walker. Thus, a hell-bent obsession began, one that lasted until he passed away in 2010 at the age of 79. There is more to the Terrell and Wilhoit story. These were not the only incidents that led to the detective's fixation on the criminal. In 1978, after being released on parole for the attempt at cashing the stolen savings bonds and various burglaries, William Ted Wilhoit relocated with his wife and daughter to Abilene, Texas. He became a ministerial student at Abilene Christian College. When John Terrell learned of Wilhoit's move, he immediately informed an Abilene police lieutenant that the criminal was now in his jurisdiction. Though he hadn't been convicted of the rape against Jennifer, Terrell told the lieutenant of the trial and the young woman's accounts of the assault. Terrell sent copies of Wilhoit's files, including a photo of the man. On September 20th of that year, an Abilene woman named Deborah was held at gunpoint and forcibly raped. The attacker restrained Deborah by using thumb cuffs. One of her children witnessed the assault. William Ted Wilhoit was identified by Deborah using the photo that Detective Terrell had supplied the Abilene police. When authorities went to arrest Wilhoit, they tracked him to the Abilene Christian College campus chapel. He was arrested, tried, and found guilty of the sexual assault against Deborah and sentenced to 40 years in prison. Detective John Terrell became increasingly convinced that he was correct in a suspicion that he had about a certain crime that had occurred several years in the past. He believed an innocent man was convicted of that crime and that Will Hoyt was the actual perpetrator. Terrell voiced his concerns to detectives overseeing Kenneth Miller's fugitive case, and he had done the same when Miller was first arrested in 1974, but little interest in Terrell's theory was given, apparently. In 1986, Sergeant Leonard Schilling, who was given the lead on a task force set up by the Fort Worth Police Department to track down fugitives, was notified that Kenneth Miller had been arrested in Las Vegas, Nevada. Schilling immediately flew to Vegas to personally escort Miller back to Fort Worth. As soon as Sergeant Schilling returned, he was visited by John Terrell and another detective, who insisted that Miller was not the perpetrator of the crime against Janelle. Much to Schilling's credit, he was open-minded about what Terrell could tell him and was soon convinced that Miller was wrongfully accused. Will Hoyt was brought to Fort Worth from prison and questioned in the 1974 assault on Janelle. Though the procedure and nature of the questioning is unknown, Will Hoyt was offered immunity from the prosecution for his confession of the assault and shooting of the TCU student, and he complied. Though his recollection of Janelle's apartment and clothing were surprisingly vivid, to be sure that Will Hoyt wasn't just telling police what they wanted to hear, they asked Will Hoyt if he'd left anything behind at the scene, to which he replied, "Well, I noticed the cylinder pin had come out of my gun." Though police had failed to find this item when they searched the scene back in 74, Janelle's boyfriend found the cylinder rod to a pistol a few days after the attack. That piece of evidence had not been released to the public at that point, so it was obvious Will Hoyt was the perpetrator. Kenneth Leslie Miller's conviction was overturned, and he was released. The only aspect of Will Hoyt's confession that did not match what was or is believed to be true was just how Janelle was shot. Will Hoyt said that instead of rising above Janelle, aiming the pistol, and shooting, that the gun had become tangled in the young woman's long hair during the struggle, and as he attempted, over and over, to pull the weapon away, it kept discharging, a bullet hitting her each time. Terrell and others continued to keep their eyes peeled and their ears open for any slip-up that would implicate Will Hoyt in Carla's abduction and murder.
About me, I went to work for the prison back starting in January of 1983. And I ended up retiring as an assistant warden. In that time, I didn't know he was in prison. But anyway, I was contacted by John Terrell. He was a detective that worked on the case. Anyway, years ago, probably in about 96 or 97, he contacted me. And he told me that this detective that was working on the cold case wanted to talk to me. So I contacted him, and we talked. Turns out Will Hoyt was in prison. The detective, Terrell, asked me if I could find out anything about it, or, you know, just general information. Well, of course I could, because I had access to that. I was a major at that time. And I looked him up and found out where he was and everything. I was talking back and forth to the detective. Long story short, I ended up having Will Hoyt transferred to my unit. Talked to him, kind of learned about him, get a feel for him. I never let him know that I knew Carla or anything about him personally, other than just an inmate that came to my unit. So I observed him for almost a year. And I had people that were talking to him that were basically prison snitches, basically just trying to find out about him, see if he would slip, talk, you know, maybe give up some information. He didn't realize who he was talking to or what. But my interviews with him, of course, I had to interview him not on the Carla Walker case, but for living assignments and work assignments and things like that for, you know, just different things prison-wise. He was very, very, very reserved. I mean, really a guarded person. I mean, he wasn't going to say anything. And I, you know, over the years, working in prison, you kind of get a feeling for a lot of people, you know, what they're capable of or might be capable of or if they're lying to you. Well, the inmates, you know, inmates are inmates. They talk to each other and they know each other and they're all criminals. So they're not surprised by a lot of criminal activity, obviously. But I put him in there intentionally to talk to him to find out if he was involved. Prison snitches. Those people come back to me with that he was a cold-blooded son of a bitch. And that he would just almost cross the line, but wouldn't, if that makes any sense. You know, he wouldn't give any specific information, knew more than he would talk about. You know, that's all speculation. There's nothing concrete. You know, that's the best we could get after all these years. And, you know, he was, as far as I know, work-wise, he kind of stayed where he was and didn't bother anybody and didn't cause any problems. So we never learned anything. Just from what the times I've met him and talked to him personally, the things I found out about him while he's in prison, and from what John Terrell was telling me and what the evidence kind of supports, that, I don't know, to me, he sounds like the one. And, but, you know, it's that's not the point. Every one of them's important. And, you know, I can only put myself in the situation that that was my daughter or my sister. There would be nothing that I wouldn't do to try to solve it. It was real hard for me to go to my senior warden and say, look, and he was a friend of mine, so I could tell him just like I'm talking right now. I said, look, this is going to sound crazy, but I had a friend of mine's sister who was abducted and murdered years ago. And the guy they think did it is in prison, and I would like to get him sent here. He looked at me like I was out of my fucking mind, but he helped me, and it didn't pan out. But, you know, that's why I was willing to put my own job and reputation on the line, because that's how much I believe in it.
Detective Terrell's dedication to Carla Walker's case and to the Walker family is astounding, and he remains something of a Fort Worth legend to this day for his determination and diligence. If it weren't for Terrell, it's likely Kenneth Miller would have spent many more years in prison, at the very least, until he could appeal the charges against him. And he is also responsible for the quick arrest of William Ted Wilhoit and the Abilene rape of Deborah. But it's important to heavily scrutinize John Terrell's detective work. Terrell relied heavily on William Ted Wilhoit's supposed words upon approaching him for arrest for burglary. While this so-called admission by Wilhoit seems incredibly damning, Terrell never seems to entertain another notion. In July of 1974, an abduction and sexual assault of a buddy's grocery store clerk took place where the attacker, Terrell claims, was identified as Wilhoit by his collection of mugshots 28 years later. The clerk says the man told her that he had killed two girls and dumped their bodies in culverts as an attempt to keep the woman from struggling, referring likely to both Carla Walker and Becky Martin, whose badly decomposed body was also found in a culvert more than a month after she disappeared in 1973. If this was indeed Wilhoit, was his remark to Terrell about Carla Walker made because he'd bragged about the publicly known cases as a weapon against his victims, a method for subduing them? Oddly, Terrell notes the sexual assault charges in this case were dropped. We were unable to find any record of the crime through newspapers, and the Fort Worth Police Department has absolutely no record of the assault occurring, not even an initial report, so it can only be reported through Terrell's lens. Perhaps Fort Worth homicide detective's original reason for dismissing Wilhoit as a suspect in Carla Walker's murder was method of operations, which has never consisted of abduction, and the attacks have always taken place in the victims' homes. Burglary always appeared to be as much a motive of the crimes that Wilhoit perpetrated, and nothing of value was taken from Carla or Rodney. Though Wilhoit did shoot one of his victims, it is likely that he did so as a result of panic. All indications lead us to believe that Carla's abductor remained calm and in control. He never used drugs to sedate his victims. Wilhoit was also below the average height for a Caucasian American male, standing only 5'7". That's 3 inches less than Carla's attacker is thought to be. He didn't wear Western-style clothing, including cowboy hats, as Carla's attacker is said to have worn. The bowling alley that Carla was abducted from was 7.5 miles from Wilhoit's residence at the time, and there was a bowling alley about a block away from his home in 1974. Former Chief Deputy Jim Minter told us that William Ted Wilhoit was heavily scrutinized and, quote, there was just nothing there, end quote. Anyway, though not reported in any major papers that we were able to find, Fort Worth Police Department Sergeant J.D. Thornton told the Fort Worth Weekly in 2003 that William Ted Wilhoit had been cleared by a DNA comparison. you have any information about the abduction and murder of Carla Walker, please contact the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, Other Persons of Interest. We'd like to thank former Tarrant County Chief Deputy Jim Minter and longtime friend to the Walker family, Chris Mayfield, for their contributions to this episode. And as always, we would like to thank the Walker family for their support. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing Gone Cold Podcast with a friend, or you can stop by our Patreon page and make a small donation. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, or virtually wherever else you listen to podcasts. We can be contacted on Facebook and Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas about the case and post pictures, so please join in. Also, check out the TrueCrimeFiles.com, where you will find an abundance of unsolved cases, all presented respectfully with compassion and fantastic insight. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Hooker Chemical Corporation dumped over 80 toxic substances at Love Connect.
With the $53 million she stole from the city of Dixon, Illinois.
Orchestrating the largest lotto scam ever.
White collar and corporate crime is a worldwide epidemic. From simple embezzlements, frauds, con artists, and Ponzi schemes, to devastating environmental disasters and economic depressions, these financially motivated crimes have shaped our world in unimaginable ways, all in the name of greed. Swindled is a podcast that uses narrative storytelling, archival audio, and immersive soundscapes to explore these true cases of white-collar and corporate crime. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever else you may get your podcasts. For more information about the show, visit our website at swindledpodcast.com and connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @SwindledPodcast.